This is Bigfoot War 1, Chapter 1, Casus Belli, by Dan Sullivan. I am Nard, the storyteller. I am Nard, the storyteller, and I am a crow. I'm going to tell you a story you're probably not going to believe. At the beginning of time, the great golden gyre spun. The fires burned, the light of the eternal realms glowed brightest. There was a silent harmony to all things, as rock, stone, created a chorus of emptiness. Great was the desolation, possible was the coming dawn, when time was born. When the first song was heard, it was the voice of a crow crying out in the night, telling the world, wake up. It was loud and heard everywhere, every time, for all time. You can still hear it. They pick it up on those, what, radio telescopes? Time to wake up. Life sprung from every corner of creation, green and red and blue. Water flowed upon the wastelands, and the world became a garden and alive with possibility. This is what the crows believe. We were here long before the funny apes, or what we often call the humans. The forest people, or the Sasquatch, were around long before the humans as well. The Bigfoot were intelligent, but in ways humans didn't understand. They were kind and loving, they were passionate and sometimes possessed by a boiling rage. The forest people were dimensional travelers, not limited to the simple forms of experience humans enjoyed. They, the Sasquatch, conceived of all things as much as was possible. They told stories and kept track of the stars. They were the explorers of portals, vortexes, and passageways between worlds, and the guardians of these strange doorways. This might not be well known to many, but the Bigfoot or Sasquatches are capable of limited invisibility. The Bigfoot are carbon-based, but their carbon is old, crystalline, strong, and yet flexible. Their molecules refract and redirect light like an octopus or a squid. They could be standing in front of you right now, or out there in the woods out back, and you wouldn't notice. They might be quietly observing you right now, from behind your house, like I said, and as you trounce and talk and prattle and pick and prod, you pay no attention because you don't notice. You funny apes pack it out. You pack it out from the woods and then move back to your toilet cities to pack it into the sewers, the rivers, the sea. The Sasquatch people watch you. They sometimes visit your cities. They have been curious about humans and observing them for tens of thousands of years. There is probably one watching you, like I said, right now, and you couldn't tell. Lucky for you, they hate your smelly cities and your cocaine nightmares. For a long time, human and Sasquatch lived side by side and knew each other. The crow didn't care about any of this. The crows are above ground level thinking, beyond scant concerns, and quite aloof. Our time is different, steeper, closer to infinity, and yet too brief. You don't understand the crow because you're funny and not to be taken seriously. Your life appears long, but it is quite boring and dumb to crow folk. We do love your garbage, though. The crow lives for about 7 or 8 of your human years. That's those of us that live in Sector 34 Hotel, or what you funny apes call the United States. We would probably live longer, but did I tell you we loved your fast food garbage? We really do. In simple terms, one crow year is like 50 human years. We live in one day the bounty of a season of life. We breathe fast the air of freedom and coarseness. We were and are the whisperers for great authors and artists, thinkers and other human wanderers and rebels. Humans pretended to know our wisdom. Nietzsche got the closest, but he was too soon. But as I said, I am Nard, and I tell stories. I'm going to tell you one right now. This story is the tale, of how one day, after a long-term set of grievances and insults, the Sasquatch people decided they have had enough. They were curious as much as tolerant, and the funny apes were often hilarious. Their antics, their inventions, their means of achieving a kind of sublime laziness only a crow could appreciate. But the funny apes weren't always so fucking funny. Humans loved war, and then learned to build even bigger bombs for war. They, the humans, built bombs big enough that the earth shook when they exploded. One day, the day before Halloween, 1961, the humans went too far. Some of these clever and funny monkeys figured out a way to capture the sun in a bottle. And others decided to make the biggest bang ever. The blast from the explosion shook the world. The forest people everywhere on Earth came alive, came awake from their late autumn sleep. They could smell the metal of the Earth dissolving. They felt the cry of the frozen lands. The Yeti, cohort of the ice, cried a scream that was heard from Nepal to Newark, New Jersey, where I live. This triggered a calling of the first war council of Sasquatch people. At the meeting of the first war council, the forest people argued. Discussed, drank mead, and tried to find balance. Balance is everything to the Sasquatch. They do not expect perfection. Perfection is for funny apes who go nowhere, as so many would say. The Bigfoot believed balance, or the acceptance of equilibrium and normal give and take of life, was possible if a being had the wisdom for it. They knew the world was terrible and amazing. It could be quite beautiful, but that doesn't mean it is beautiful. Fun fact. Another name for human in the language of the Sasquatch is Stooges, pronounced Stoogiz, roughly translated messy folk. The messy folk were, to the Sasquatch, a curiosity. For most of the age of the Stoogis, the messy folk mainly built cities, piling themselves upon each other, building mountains of stone and brick, and filling some local river with their Stoogis waste. It wasn't pretty, but it was limited in scope, restricted, and often doomed in the end. It was roughly 300 years ago that the Sasquatch people noticed something new. The Stoogis began building machines, machines of black and smoke, machines of noise and clatter, machines that move faster and faster. Sasquatch understood machines, they just didn't need them. If a Bigfoot needed some amazing gadget or thingamabob, they had allies in nearby dimensions, a portal jump away. Those other peoples were wiser, older, more advanced than the Stoogis. It was during the Great Smoke, as the Sasquatch called it, or World War II, that the Bigfoot began noticing a greater and far more dangerous eventuality. The creation of technology for the undoing of all creation. There were forest people at Hiroshima. There were forest people at Nagasaki. There were forest people there when those cities were burned, destroyed, with the first atom bombs in 1945. All the Sasquatch remember, they all remember the clamor and the screams, not just the other Bigfoot, not just the Stoogis being burnt alive, but of nature itself screaming and crying. They, the Sasquatch, from all over the world could feel the tears, the sadness of nature. Nature cried for several months. At the first war council, there was heated debate about what to do, generally. The Bigfoot eschewed war, They were okay with limited engagements for limited goals, but they did not understand the bloodthirsty side of Stugis, or what the funny apes called total war. Side note, funny doesn't really translate for the Bigfoot people. In their language, it usually means two things: A, pathetic, or B, tricky. And to be tricky among the Sasquatch is not to be trusted. You're not trustworthy if you're tricky. The forest people remember what happened to the Neanderthal, how the funny apes were really good at lying. Bigfoot understood lies, and I can tell you, crows have always told the best lies for fun. But the human lies ran deeper, uglier, and they were so believable, so good at grifting. The Neanderthal people were kind and connected, much like the Bigfoot and the other sentient creatures that lived on the earth tens of thousands of years ago. But Stugis would trick them. They would tell tales of the moon and the sky. They would claim power over the tides and the volcanoes. They were gifted at counting. Some call it mathematics, as the Bigfoot would say. And it was the Stugis that created mathematics. And so it was long ago, piece by piece, village by village, the Stugis or Homo sapiens or funny apes killed and ate and raped the Neanderthal out of existence. Gentleness or kindness was not a mental obstacle for the Stugis. Many saw it as weakness. The few Stugis who knew kindness to be a strength, they were forced to hide, to cower, to watch as this atrocity was carried out. These events transpired over a few centuries of time, 65,000 years ago, as the crow folk recall. But I'm getting off topic. The first war council, called after that great shake in 1961, the first war council lasted 12 days because the Bigfoot had never called a war council. They were unsure as to the agenda. The Clevis, or jungle Bigfoot of Africa and South America, demanded justice. The Tagan clan of Canada were not clear on what the outcomes would be. And they tended to worry a lot. The few forest people left alive from Europe were battered and worn, filled with distress. The war had been over for almost 20 years, but they were still recovering. And then there had been Stalin and his secret wars to destroy the Sasquatch. The European Bigfoot chose to remain silent at the meeting. They wanted no more pain. The most respected Bigfoot there was Bordeaux. Bordeaux was a Sasquatch from California near Eureka. He had fought skirmishes with loggers and hunters, so he knew something of human violence and their weapons. Towards the end of the council, when nothing would be or could be agreed upon, these councils required unanimous consent, Bordeaux stood up to speak. It was June the 14th, 1962. The world is built upon life and the kiss of the moon and the stars. The world is made of movement and dance, and we know this, we've always known this. When we first met the Stugis, they were what they still are, small and cold and frightened and tricky. Our compassion led us to help and to nurture. We even stood by as the Yug folk, the Neanderthal, were wiped out, all of them. Their men killed, their treasures stolen, their women defiled, their children eaten. We thought, didn't we, as a people, they'll learn, give them time, right? Because we see the line of time and we know the depth of eternity. But our sense of importance and beauty never really worked with them, did it? The tricky apes, the hairless monkeys, the Stugis, yeah, it never really worked, did it? Our tribes and clans taught, and some humans found balance, but so many were impatient, wanting to know things that they were not prepared to know. The Creator says, make your home a garden. The Stugis say, make your home big. We took pity and laughed, and then not so long ago, as our own people were destroyed in their war, we stopped laughing and took notice. They are clever. They are counters. They have means of recording all and yet no means of understanding or remembering beyond the "it is mine" perspective. And when their leaders attempt justice, it ends in murder, rounding up other Stugas and killing them without honor, without respect. We saw this in the last war too, and our people among the Klob tribes, the people in Russia, they're still being put in places of murder today. So I understand the heat of the Clevis clans, and their voices are heard, but I'm going to offer a compromise and a pause. I say we give them more time, perhaps a Humpton age, which is about 40 years. They have young, and the young can often learn, where the old are too scared to learn. Therefore, we must give their brood time to think, to meditate, to consider. If in the next Humpton age these tricky apes do not change, then we have no choice. I will not hear the earth cry again and be silent and reflective. I will not feel the tears of this garden again. There is no balance in needless murder. The other members of the council heard this. They stood up and cheered. Bordeaux preached caution against war with the Stugas, but he also set conditions. Bordeaux's words touched most, and the Clevis were assuaged, knowing that their time will come. But they didn't expect the tricky little people to change. The Clevis had long memories, and as Bigfoot, they lived a long time, so they would wait and see and prepare for war. You may not know this, but crows know this. There are many thousands of Sasquatch tribes, covens, Claggett gangs, strobe armies on Earth at any given time. The total number of Sasquatch living on Earth or traversing dimensions near Earth can be measured in billions. Billions, maybe billions of 12 to 15 foot tall hairy creatures capable of sprinting up to 50 miles an hour, jogging for hours at 25 miles an hour. They can hurl a 300 pound rock a third of a mile and toss a tree spear up to a full mile. They can see as well at night as they do during the day in the pitch black. They can see, and their hearing is considered better than bats. They use echolocation to find their way sometimes, and can carry on low-frequency hum chats with other Sasquatch around the world, all without technology, all given to them by the Creator. By the way, a Claggett gang is a group of 400 or 500 Sasquatch that roam remote parts of this world and other desolate planets. They are foragers and hunters, often hunting ceremonially, and sometimes they hunt people. When someone disappears in a forest, and another clever monkey says, "Holy crap, where's Uncle Harold?" This could have been another victim of a Claggett gang. These gangs were formed after the first great insult, when the humans tricked and stole and murdered the Neanderthal peoples, and were on the first rung of the shunning. Many rungs on that ladder would follow when many of these gangs join forces. It is called a Klungit army. Strobe armies are Yeti armies primarily in Siberia and Asia. Strobe armies are motivated by honor and adventure and seek after gold and silver and spice and rubies and tasty meals. There are thought to be, according to Crow reports, millions of Yeti in these armies, hiding in seclusion, nestled in the Himalayas. It is possible that some of these forces fought along Chiang Kai-shek during the Chinese Civil War. It is thought that Mao Zedong had special arrangements with these strobe armies, and they protected him during the Cultural Revolution 1966 to 1976. Hard to say. But these are the pirate Sasquatch, the adventurers, soldiers for hire in more than one dimension. The first war council ended with a decision to wait, and so time passed. It was after Fukushima in 2011 that the High Council of the Sasquatch people were called to a meeting again at the second war council. The meeting was held at Tiggs Bluff in South Dakota, not far from an abandoned gold mine. Tiggs Bluff was an old boom-bust town from frontier times, But now it was just several dilapidated buildings along a dirt road, surrounded by forest and stone. "All to order," cried the High Lord of the Forest Wardens. "All to order. Take your spot," screamed his assistant. The High Lord was named Cordos. He was a Sasquatch from the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State. Cordos was 13 feet tall, weighed 800 pounds, and he had seen a great deal. A Sasquatch can live up to 500 human years, and this can be a lot for any being to handle, if what they do is watch and listen, observe. He'd seen human wars, revolutions, and greed. He'd seen their beauty and their love, too. He knew them to be mercurial creatures, dangerous but also willing to sacrifice on occasion. He did not want war, but he knew that many Bigfoot did, and the Stooges had been given a chance. They had been given a chance. Cordos had a Stooges or human friend named Deborah, Dr. Deborah Young. Deborah was an anthropologist from the University of Washington in Seattle and had spent her time in graduate school studying the Salish people, the Pacific Northwest. Deborah understood much of the Sasquatch language and their use of gestures to fill in the gaps of syntax. She also knew they had a spooky, if not explicable way of knowing what some other Sasquatch was thinking. It was kind of like mind reading. Not exactly. The Sasquatch used gestures, but also a kind of low-frequency bone clicking. Like a weird dance, they could send a pulse around the world, transmitting simple ideas of exceptional importance. Deborah and Cordos met while she was exploring the forests of the Olympic Peninsula. And they had what could only be described as a love affair. Not impossible between Sasquatch and Stooges, but exceedingly rare, and thought to be disgusting by most crows. Ugh. "Crows can't mate with humans, and we are quite glad. We have sung songs, we created operas about this joy." "Are you real?" was the first thing Deborah said to Cordos. "Are you kind?" was his response. He did speak a little the Stooges language. They had no children yet, even though it was not impossible and very disgusting to crows when it did happen. The Second War Council was held in April of 2012. Deborah was at this meeting as an observer only. Rarely were humans, Stooges, invited into the inner circle of the Sasquatch. Deborah was respectful and kind and generally ignored or tolerated by the Bigfoot. Deborah listened as best she could, still not fully understanding the intricacy of the Sasquatch communication, but she got the gist. She knew they were talking about humans. She could tell they were angry, angrier than she'd ever seen any person, human or Bigfoot, angrier than she'd ever seen anyone ever before. Something about that primordial rage scared her because she understood it was real and justified and kind of directed at her. "Our children are dying, our waters are unclean, the salmon are covered in scars and illness, the seashores are becoming gray," said Tool of Oregon. "They know only filth and death and tricks. We've had 200,000 years of their tricks. I'm tired of their tricks," said Kerr of England. "There is an intolerable smell to what they did, that dark and sticky, overwhelming in its power. It's filled with demons. Our people who live near the Great Scar, Fukushima, they cry every night for themselves and the wretched Stooges. The time for patience is over," said Zono of Japan. A representative of the Clevis was about to speak when Deborah broke into the conversation. "I know I have no privileges here, no right to be heard. It is not my place to defend the Stooges, though I am one of them. But I ask for more time. I think the recent events will awaken a spirit, a renewal in my people. And I only ask that you think on this. Think a little longer." "Think a little longer before you attack the Stooges," You speak lies, tricky woman, yelled Durg of the Clevis. Durg was from South Africa and had seen so clearly what humans do to the land, to each other. I'm not lying. I am touching the earth. Deborah kneeled down and placed her left hand on her left knee and her right hand palm down onto the ground. This is a sign of honesty and submission among the Sasquatch. Trick! Lies, trick, lies. She lay with Cordos in the forest wallow, and now she pretends to be like you and I, but look, she is dirty and tricky and filled with lies. I speak my truth. You speak as you can. You cannot help but to deceive. Durg paused in a speech, knowing that the tricky apes were themselves susceptible to deception. But I am an honorable and fair being, and I propose a trade, Cordos. We give the dirty deceivers 14 more years. 14 years. Human years for a price. Cordos knew Durg was angry. And he knew Durg was a gifted speaker and conjurer of schemes, so he asked a question, fearing the answer. What do you propose? I propose a flesh offering. And the crowd gathered at that abandoned town in South Dakota screamed with joy. Through Durg's clicks and hums and low-frequency dance, they all knew what he was proposing, all except for Deborah. This is the stain of Stugus on you, responded Cordos. You are the stained one, replied Durg. Cordos looked at Deborah with sadness. Durg looked at Deborah with bloodlust. Deborah stayed in her position of submission, sensing that things were about to get dire. 14 more years, 14 more years of human arrogance? That's a small sacrifice to be sure of our cause. Cordos said, and Durg is right. The time of half measures is over. I have lived over 400 years, and my time will be over soon enough. I agree with Durg of the Clevis. We cannot simply let this insult pass, so I accept the need for a flesh offering on one condition, that my final wish be law, and by law none shall question. What trick is this, Cordos? Durg spoke with a noticeable hesitation. No trick, no joke, no smile, no more words. If a flesh sacrifice can be acceptable, then I, as High Lord, must be the sacrifice. It was under my watch that the Great Scar formed, and it was my counsel that led us to this point. What do you want? That after I am dead, you elect a war leader to prepare our people, and also watching, with sincerity, for any change among the Stugus, and that Deborah be allowed to return to her world, if only as a messenger, if only to give the Stugus a chance to change. Deborah knew what the words meant. She leapt up and ran to Cordos and held him, holding on to his right leg, crying tears of love and sadness. You can't do this. But she knew he must, so her words were subdued. I am responsible, Cordos said, but he knew he had never loved anyone as much as her and didn't want to leave her. The Sasquatch people allowed Deborah and Cordos one final night, and in the morning, near the Stone of Wrath, a burial ground from older times, Cordos was sacrificed, and his spirit returned to the sky. The second war council was over. The elders spent their time over the coming months deciding, determining, and discussing who should be their war leader. Eventually, they decided upon Durg of the Clevis. Deborah returned to lecture at the University of Washington. She knew there were a dozen years that separated humanity from the worst disaster no human could imagine. Something so ugly that the mere sight of it would cause many to drop dead. She spoke at conferences, she wrote articles on the need to address Fukushima, but the humans played games and watched movies and raped and stole and invaded their neighbor's land. They committed greater crimes in order to steal the black blood of the earth. and they squandered the little time they had left, not knowing or understanding the sword of Damocles that hung over them. Ignorance is bliss, and for humans, ignorance is a deeply addictive drug. One night, Deborah heard a song, an old song that Cordos had loved. Just One of Those Things, sung by Frank Sinatra. She cried as she remembered their time together. Deborah did not give up trying to raise alarm about Fukushima, the state of the natural world, the madness that led the human race to this point. Her colleagues mocked her, she barely made tenure, and was left with one freshman class, Intro to Humans, Anthropology 101, and a basement office near the boiler. Cordos left Deborah with a gift, however. Cordos left Deborah with a child, a boy. A boy that Deborah would name Charles. She was left with this gift on that final night, and she would raise the child to know his father and his customs. In middle school, Charles drew a picture of his dad. The children laughed. And the Sasquatch, they prepared. Derg prepared. They formed alliances with the orca. They formed alliances with the raccoon and the squirrel and the coyotes. The wolves, like the crow, were more or less neutral. They would be happy just eating the dead. Other forest creatures also decided to stay out of it and promised to not interfere with what must be done. Humans had no allies but each other, and that wasn't much. The years passed, and the humans grew dumber. Human children were abused and sold. Human old people were tossed into the streets. Derg and others saw no evidence that it was getting better. Instead, the Stugas piled one insult upon another. They were even teaching their machines now, teaching their brilliant machines how to be tricky and evil like them. Derg sent out a war cry, October the 1st, 2026. A hum, a vibration. It was heard around the world, not by people. It was not the signal of the attack. It was a warning order. It was eerily quiet those days following the war cry. Even human newscasters report a strange calmness among the intemperate masses of hairless monkeys. And then there was Carl and Trevor. Unbeknownst to Carl and Trevor, two men who lived in a camper near Port Angeles, Washington. Unknown to them, there was a company or roughly 200 Sasquatch organizing near the tree line, not far from their campfire. Carl and Trevor were old friends. They worked on boats and crabbed and fished and drank and smoked. They would argue till midnight about most obscure topics, to include aliens, monsters, ghosts, weird stuff. And they would talk about the best lures to use to catch trout. And sometimes they would talk about Bigfoot. Something odd's going on, Trev. Huh? I get this feeling that the clouds are angry and the trees have eyes. Carl had just consumed 4 tabs of premium LSD he'd bought in Vancouver, BC. Carl wasn't a heavy drug user, and he hadn't done LSD since he dropped out of college several decades earlier. I got this sensation. This feeling on my spine, a feeling of harbingers, bringers of destruction and pain. What the fuck does that even mean, Carl? It's like the world is our stage and our work is a cage, and the monsters live in the cracks at work and they stare at me, and I stare back sometimes. Did you just start your in-between job at Joe's? In-between jobs were the gigs these fishermen did between fishing seasons. They chopped wood, they logged, sometimes they did some grow operation maintenance for the local cannabis farmer named Joe Slagan. Joe paid well, and Carl was a gifted handyman and a hard worker. This was a Friday night after work, and both men were satisfied with their oasis in the woods. Joe's great, but the cracks in the world are widening, and the various realms are at knife point. Carl, you took too much acid. I didn't. I took the government-recommended amount. The men laughed, and then Trevor heard a sound like branches breaking, ground being crushed. Are the Bears back? Trevor muttered. Trevor and Carl's place was near Hurricane Ridge, and periodically a hungry bear would wander into their camp and look for food. So it seemed the bear was back. Trev, that's not a bear, that's our chastisement. Carl said these words, looking up to a clear night and a full moon. Sure, Carl. I mean it. The forest people are angry, and we've given them reasons because we're assholes. But we don't think we're assholes, so that makes it way worse. Forest people? What the fuck, Carl? The Wookiee, the Bigfoot, the Sasquatch, the forest people, you can feel it. I don't feel nothing. I've been drinking Jack all night, and I don't care if the forest people come by. Don't mock them, Trev. I will. Don't mock them, they see you. Carl, there is no fucking thing as Bigfoot. There's never been no fucking thing as Bigfoot. I get so fucking sick of the Sasquatch bullshit. No way something like that lives in the woods. What's your fucking problem? Trevor was belligerent and tired. Trevor paused his ranting for a moment and then peered with squinted eyes past the fire, past the open meadow, past time itself into the woods across the way. And at that moment, a tree spear tossed by a lower-level younger Sasquatch named Giblis hit Trevor square in the chest. Trevor's last words were, "Fuck." Carl, high on LSD and whiskey and weed, instinctively got on the ground and held his hands up. Carl didn't have a driver's license because he'd been pulled over a few too many times for drinking and driving. He was lucky. What he did as a reflex saved his life. The world was waking up. Morning in many places, the darkness still covering half the world, but a wake-up call was being heard. The Sasquatch were storming out of the hills and woods and fields and swamps that night, from Seattle to Chicago, from Maine to Florida, from Tibet to Toledo, to Chile to Siberia. Everywhere on Earth, the forest people were waging war. Humans were shocked, caught off guard, paralyzed, and stunned. Many software engineers at Microsoft in Redmond, who'd been working late and into the morning, saw the armies carrying torches and spears and hammers made from stone and steel, storming angrily out of the Cascade foothills. They and their high-tech world observed all of this as their cars were smashed and everything was turned upside down. On Wall Street, bankers and other kinds of grifters were shocked and amazed at the sudden appearance of Bigfoot storming out of Central Park. How could they be there? Where were they coming from? Questions too big for the tiny, tricky, lying mind of a human financial analyst. The world was spinning the other direction now. Trevor was dead, a giant spear sticking out of him. Carl was captured, a prisoner being led to a makeshift camp in the deep woods of the Olympic Mountains. He didn't know this at first. Governments were in panic. Some were preparing to launch nuclear weapons, none too sure where to target the nukes. And Carl was right. The forest people are pissed off. And today is chastisement day. This is the end of Chapter 1 of Bigfoot War 1. I'm sorry it wasn't better. I'll try harder next time.